Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 19th of July. First hour of the program, it's all things political, as it always is on Mondays at 9. Steve Kornacki is our guest, news editor for Salon. He's written about politics for the New York Observer and Roll Call, and his work has also appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and on the Daily Beast. We'll be talking about a number of issues, starting with the economy with Steve. The second hour of our program today, this year, of course, marks the 50th anniversary of To Kill a Mockingbird, and we will have two guests with us. Scout is going to join us, Mary Badham, who played Scout or Louise in Jean Louise Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird, and Charles Shields will be with us as well, author of Mockingbird, A Portrait of Harper Lee. So we should have two very good hours, and you are welcome to join our conversation anytime the next 2 hours. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And our guest is Steve Kornacki. He is the news editor for Salon. Hi, Steve. Thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be here, sure.
You wrote in a piece July 14 about, yes, it really is the economy stupid, saying that you believe strictly from a polling standpoint, it's never really mattered what Obama does or doesn't do in his first 2 years. His approval rating in 2010 always going to be lousy, and his party always going to fare badly in the midterms thanks to the economy.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, I guess it's sort of a depressing message in some ways, but I think if we look at sort of the history of the modern presidency, the presidency in the media age, you find that there are some sort of overriding factors that kind of dictate and drive, you know, presidential approval ratings. And it doesn't mean that, you know, that the actions presidents take aren't important, aren't consequential, don't have serious, you know, long-term implications. It's just that when you try to take these short-term measurements, you know, for instance, right now, a year and a half into Obama's term, you know, the tendency of people who watch politics closely and sort of live and breathe this stuff is to try to draw all sorts of meaning from, you know, from his approval rating and to say, well, okay, you know, he started at 75% in January of 2009, and here we are in July of 2010, and he's at, you know, I don't know, 45%, let's say. So that's a pretty significant drop off, and let's look at all the things that happened and that he tried to do between then and now, and that should explain, you know, why he's had this drop off. And I think that's where the analysis kind of goes wrong, because it's not, you know, the drop off is not people responding to sort of individual items. It's really just sort of the mood, the overall national mood. And it's not a good mood. And we knew before Obama came to office that it wasn't going to be a good mood, because he came to office, you know, a couple months after Wall Street, you know, collapsed. About a year after the country, you know, plunged into a recession, we knew joblessness was going to surge, you know, at least in the first year of his presidency, that even if that ebbed, even when that ebbed, it would be a long time before people ever really kind of felt the economy was turning around. And so, you know, you're dealing with an unemployment rate that I think everybody, you know, more or less expected at this point, and you're dealing with economic conditions that were pretty much predictable, no matter what he did, again, you know, from the beginning of his presidency. And when you're dealing with that, the overall national mood is just sort of poisoned against, you know, whoever is running the country.
Right.
And the parallel I always draw is to Ronald Reagan in the first 2 years of his presidency. He was the last president before Obama who dealt with double-digit unemployment. And if you look at where Ronald Reagan was at this exact point in his presidency, it is identical to where Barack Obama is now. And
mm-hmm.
And we look at the Reagan story, we tend to forget those first 2 years. It's entirely possible that'll end up happening with Obama.
Mm. And add to that the worst environmental disaster in history, a war in Afghanistan that's not going very well, and the mood is even gloomier.
Sure. I always say the three big drivers, I think, of presidential, you know, popularity or lack thereof are, the overwhelming one is always the economy. The second one, you know, is war. When there's sort of a long, intractable war going on, as people are sort of concluding Afghanistan is, that will drag down a president's, you know, approval numbers. On the flip side is if there's a sort of a war that's executed rather quickly, rather cleanly from an American standpoint, that can elevate a president's popularity. You think of like George H.W. Bush after the Gulf War in 1991, he had 91% approval because he was seen as prosecuting a war successfully. And the third major driver is sort of, you know, scandal and just sort of the basic idea of competence. You know, if there's Iran-Contra with Reagan, if there's Watergate with Nixon, sort of the Lewinsky thing with Clinton, you know, something like that can also, you know, obviously will have a major effect on presidential popularity. And yeah, as you mentioned, Obama's got Afghanistan on his plate. So, I mean, there's another one.
Yeah. You say in the same piece, you'd be the first to admit that if there isn't measurable improvement in the economy by 2012, he'll be in serious trouble. The obvious question, although there's not an easy answer to this, is what does he do to improve the economy and to increase the number of people who have jobs?
Sure. And this is where I say, like, you know, it's not inconsequential what a president actually does, because I know that the message that I'm sort of sounding here may make it seem like, hey, it doesn't really matter. Well, it does. It just doesn't matter to the short-term approval ratings. And this is a perfect example of that, because obviously the major action that the administration's taken to kind of confront the economy is and has been the stimulus that was passed early last year. And that was a stimulus that, you know, lots of people on the left felt just didn't go far enough. It wasn't big enough. There wasn't enough investment in it. There just wasn't enough emphasis. There wasn't enough money there to create jobs in the eyes of a lot of people on the left. That's sort of the test. Was the stimulus big enough or not? And if it wasn't, is there anything, you know, is the administration willing to push really hard? And are they capable of pushing hard enough to get sort of a supplemental stimulus done? You know, in the next few months. That will, you know, increase the number of jobs, that will measurably improve the economy in a way that voters will, you know, will respond to. And I think of the, you know, again, the example of Ronald Reagan. At this point in his presidency, his economic program, which mainly consisted of tax cuts, heavy, heavy tax cuts in the first, you know, 6 months of his presidency in 1981, that economic program was considered by the public overwhelmingly to be a failure at this point in his presidency because it hadn't yet sort of moved the needle on joblessness. By 1984, unemployment was falling pretty steadily, and it was considered an overwhelming success by the public. You know, time will tell if we'll look back at sort of the stimulus, you know, the same way. If the unemployment rate has dropped, say, 2 points, 2 years from now, I think you're going to see entirely different polls, an entirely different perception of what the stimulus was and what the stimulus represented. But, you know, if the critics of the administration are correct, if the administration sort of settled, you know, for something less than they could and should have pushed for, then Obama will pay a price for it in 2012. And then there's a real consequence to what they decided to do on the stimulus.
Let's talk a little bit about extending unemployment benefits, which evidently will probably happen tomorrow when Senator Byrd's successor should be sworn in. Why have the Republicans blocked that? It seems as though it doesn't do them any political good to be opposed to that.
Yeah, I mean, the simple answers are, one, you know, they're the party that wants to block everything right now. You know, they made that calculation at the beginning of Obama's presidency. It's a calculation that's very much rooted in the strategy that the Republicans pursued the last time the Democrats controlled the White House in both chambers of Congress. That was in 1993 and 1994 when Bill Clinton was president and we had comparable Democratic majorities in the House and the Senate. The Republicans then dug their heels in on just, you know, literally everything Clinton pursued, except the North American Free Trade Agreement. That was the one exception back then. So you're seeing that same strategy now. The other thing is the Republicans think they have a real winning issue in the deficit and in the idea of spending and reckless spending and the idea of Obama, you know, sort of spending the country, you know, into bankruptcy. And so they're trying to connect the unemployment. Some Republicans, I should say, are trying to connect the unemployment issue to that, basically saying, hey, listen, you know, this is the administration. This is the party that spent record sums of money the last 2 years. Now they want more. All we're asking is that they pay for it. Not every Republican is on board with this strategy. I do know that. But that it reflects a sort of a line of thinking that I think is pretty prominent in the Tea Party movement, which is, you know, really kind of driving the Republican Party these days. There's a lot of pressure on Republican leaders, I think, to cater to Tea Party sentiment. The Tea Party really is the Republican Party base. And so I think this is something that resonates with that crowd. And I think that's you know, that's part of this calculation too.
Yeah, we'll go to the Tea Party in a moment. What do you know about Senator Byrd's replacement?
Well, I guess you go from the oldest senator to the youngest. It's you know, it it doesn't get more stark a contrast than that, I guess. It's also sort of this interesting trend now of you know, sort of behind the scenes aides taking places in the United States Senate. You had Charlie Crist appoint his longtime aide in Florida, George Lemieux. You have in Delaware, you know, Joe Biden's longtime aide, Ted Kaufman. He's the interim senator there. And now you have the you know, Joe Manchin's aide in West Virginia, Cart Goodwin, who's going to be the short term senator there. It's only for a few. And you also had Paul Kirk, another longtime behind the scenes guy in Massachusetts, you know, before Scott Brown was elected there. So that's I can't remember the last time that many sort of backroom folks were in prominent places in the Senate like that. One thing that I found really interesting in the press conference, though, on Friday when Joe Manchin, the governor of West Virginia, announced this pick. You know, Joe Manchin wants to run for the seat this fall. He's in good shape to win because he's very popular in the state, and you know, it's a state that's never been friendly to Obama, but Joe Manchin has really carved out a reputation as a very sort of conservative Democrat, pro-life, pro-gun, pro-coal. These are issues that really resonate in West Virginia. So he should be safe, but he obviously, I think, was spooked by what happened in Massachusetts, where the Democrats lost a race nobody thought they could lose earlier this year, and by the national climate. And when he introduced Cart Goodwin at the press conference on Friday, he started talking about he was trying to salute Robert Byrd. He didn't, but you could see this really strange language he chose. Instead of just saying, you know, this will always be known as Robert Byrd's Senate seat, he said this will always be known as the Senate seat of the people of West Virginia that was held by Robert Byrd for more than 50 years.
Oh, my
years.
Gosh.
And I thought immediately, you know, that famous line that Scott Brown used at the very end of the Senate race in Massachusetts where, you know, a moderator asked him, you know, if you win, you're going to have Ted Kennedy's Senate seat. And he interrupted the moderator, and he said, well, with all due respect, it's not Ted Kennedy's Senate seat. It's the people's Senate seat. And that line really resonated in Massachusetts. And you could just see Joe Manchin just taking pains to avoid falling for that
right.
same kind of trap because he wants to run this fall, and he does not want to be the next Martha Coakley.
Yeah. Well, let's go to those mama grizzlies here for a moment. You also wrote a fascinating piece about the state Senate contest between Harry Reid and Sharon Angle, and that it could be the 2010 test for Palin in 2012.
Yeah, I mean, and I wrote that before a poll came out on Friday, I believe it was, Friday morning, that showed Harry Reid now 7 points ahead of Sharon Angle, 44% to 37%. In that race, that's extraordinary. When you consider Harry Reid's standing in Nevada right now, this is a race that he has absolutely no business winning. It's a race he has absolutely no business being competitive in. Given, you know, the climate right now in 2010 nationally runs against the Democrats. It's particularly strong in Nevada, and it's particularly strong in Nevada against, you know, a guy like Reid, who not only has been in Washington, you know, for about three decades, he's also the face of the Senate Democrats,
yes,
in Washington. So, you know, he was, if you looked earlier this year, at the time, the two most likely Republican candidates, Sue Loudon and Danny Tarkanian, this is before Angle really emerged, you know, they were both consistently running, you know, double-digit leads over Harry Reid in polls for November. And we went back and we looked at that time, and we could find two examples. In the last 30 years, two examples of incumbent senators who had been trailing in polls by more than 5 points in their reelection years. We can only find two examples of senators like that who would come back to win. Every other senator who had been trailing by more than 5 points in their reelection year lost, and there were quite a few of them. Harry Reid, you know, fell into that category. So they're really, you know, he looked like a goner, but he's drawn this opponent, Sharon Angle, from the far right of the Republican Party. She is the Tea Party candidate. You know, on paper, she's very much another Sarah Palin. Lots of provocative, controversial statements. The Tea Party crowd loves her, very polarizing, very divisive. And what she's allowed Harry Reid to do, at least for the first month of their general election campaign, is to stop making this race just a referendum on Harry Reid and the Democrats. And it's now equally, if not more so, a referendum on Sharon Angle. If the Republicans had just nominated sort of a generic candidate out there, they'd be 15 points ahead and there'd be nothing Harry Reid could do to win this race. But because they nominated Sharron Angle, they made this race just as much about their candidate. And right now, at least, the voters are rejecting their candidate. And I just look at Sarah Palin and the idea of her running in 2012, and I see, you know, as I said, if the economy is turned around, it doesn't matter who the Republicans nominate. Barack Obama's going to get reelected. But let's play along with the Republican scenario sure. here and say the economy has not improved in 2012 and Barack Obama is very vulnerable. Nevada offers you a lesson in what can happen if you nominate Sarah Palin, I think. If the economy hasn't improved and Obama's vulnerable, Republicans need to nominate a reassuring candidate who can capitalize on that environment. If they nominate Sarah Palin, they're doing the equivalent of what you know, the Republicans in Nevada have done. They're nominating a candidate who will be, the race will be a referendum on that candidate just as much as it is on Obama. And I think you're seeing, you know, Harry Reid's taken a 7-point lead in Nevada, and I think something similar, you know, could happen in a Palin-Obama race where mm-hmm. the Republicans could take a winnable race and just sort of flush it down the drain.
Steve Kornacki, news editor for Salon, our guest for all things political today, and we're welcoming your phone calls. We have one line open if you'd like to grab it. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we talk about To Kill a Mockingbird, one of my all-time favorite movies. It's the 50th anniversary of the book this year, and the 50th anniversary of the movie will be 2 years from now. We'll have two guests with us. Scout will be here, Mary Badham, the young woman who played Scout. She was just a kid. She was 10 years old when she played Scout in the movie. And we'll also be speaking with a gentleman who's written just a wonderful book about Harper Lee. As you know, she has not granted very many interviews, and so we'll look at the reason why, and he has interviewed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who knew her pretty well and has written an exhaustive biography. Charles Shields, his name is. So that's coming up, hour number two. We go to your phone calls now for Steve and Jeff from Superior, our first caller. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
My concern is, like, for the next 50 years in the United States, especially in politics, when it comes to the social contract, like things like gun control and pro-choice and, you know, pro-gay marriage, who's a liberal voice we can look to nationally, you think? And is it possible that Senator Feingold, if he gets reelected, would he possibly be able to position himself to be a national spokesman for liberal issues like the Kennedys were or Hubert Humphrey?
It's a good question. I think in a lot of ways, you know, Russ Feingold, you know, already plays that role, not necessarily on those issues, but on civil liberties issues, for instance. You know, Russ Feingold really, in a lot of ways, was the go-to guy and has been the go-to guy, you know, for liberals, certainly during the Bush era. I mean, he was the guy, I think, more than just about anybody else in the Senate who was speaking up, you know, when it came to the Patriot Act, when it came to, you know, sort of the civil liberties record of the Bush administration. So he's you know, sort of played that role. I think when you look ahead to sort of saying the next Kennedy or something, I don't know if I could really put a name on it. I do think it's interesting when you start looking at, you know, sort of gay marriage and gay rights. I think it's very much a generational question. I don't necessarily know that politician has emerged yet, because a lot of, you know, there's a lot of politicians on the left are still sort of coming around to it. Some are sort of out front on gay marriage and out front on gay rights. But I think it's really the next generation that I think is going to produce, you know, the leaders who are sort of who've always sort of, you know, been there on gay rights and have never needed to sort of have any awakenings on it. I think we have to see sort of what the next generation who emerges from the next generation on that.
And there was something extraordinary about the Kennedys as well. Kennedy was a tireless worker, but he also had two brothers who were assassinated and who were, one was president, for heaven's sake. So he had a special place, I think, in American history.
Sure. I mean, that was the thing about Kennedy. He had that celebrity and that star power that he could actually use sort of, you know, it's sort of a cliche to say it, but he could sort of use it for good. He could draw attention to issues. He could, you know, he could sort of be the popular face of, you know, of things and of ideas, and he could really get attention for whatever his agenda was. You know, there are lots of workhorses in the Senate. There are lots of workhorses in the Senate right now who people just, you know, don't know about and don't talk about, because, you know, the thing about Ted Kennedy was, and it's not his fault, certainly, but it's just sort of the way the media works, and it's just sort of the way,
right,
you know, politics works. You know, just being a workhorse and just sort of being a legislative master will get you plenty of appreciation on Capitol Hill. But when you try to sort of bring in, you know, popular opinion and sort of bring in the masses, you know, you need to sort of be interesting personally. Mm-hmm. And just Ted Kennedy always was. And again, I'm not sure right now, you look at the Senate, I'm not, you know, if Obama had not run for president, was in the Senate right now, I'd be pointing to him, or if Hillary Clinton were still there. But I'm not sure I necessarily see that right now.
Jeff, thanks for the call. John in Eau Claire, hi.
Hello, how are you all this morning?
Fine, John. How are you?
Just fine. An observation and then a question. Ronald Reagan's close-quote prosperity wasn't based on tax cuts. It was based on deficit spending. And people should recall that the lowest federal deficit in our lifetimes was when Jimmy Carter was president, and we had a dreadful economy. There's no connection between the two. But my question is, in terms of Barack Obama, those of us who are moderates, not liberals, not anything else, but just moderates and progressives, my disappointment with him has been his unwillingness to work on the issue of unemployment, to publicly discuss the issues, attempt solutions, and talk about the problems. And I think the parallel president was FDR, who didn't ever run away from the problem and continually tried to confront it, albeit continually frustrated. And at similar points in his presidency, he had extraordinary popularity because he worked on the issue, not because of his success.
I think you make an excellent point. Is the president concentrating on unemployment? If so, why not? Steve?
Yeah, I hear criticisms sort of like that a lot, and I'm sympathetic to it. I think there's, you know, in some ways you can look at it and say there is more he should be doing. I mean, I think it gets back to the stimulus debate and to the stimulus question. I mean, I'm very sympathetic to the argument that the stimulus didn't go far enough. It didn't do enough to address all the issues in the economy, but it certainly didn't do enough to address jobs. The flip side of it is, if you look at the realities that the administration was confronting on Capitol Hill in terms of getting a package through, the realities of getting the 60 votes that they needed in the Senate, I know progressives get tired of hearing the 60-vote excuse, and a lot of times I think it is used as an excuse, but it's also a reality. Trying to corral not just a majority in the House, which isn't too difficult, although there are challenges there because there are plenty of conservative Democrats in the House, but trying to corral 60 votes in the Senate for anything, it can be brutal. And you know, to actually get something through in this day and age requires watering down. And that's really been the theme to me of the first, 18 months of the Obama presidency. I mean, you can look at it on one hand and say this has been, there have been some significant and almost extraordinary achievements, whether it's health care, whether it's the financial reform bill that's going through now, whether it's the stimulus. I mean, he's done some major, serious legislation. On the other hand, are there massive loopholes in the financial reform bill? Yes. It is the health insurance program that was passed, in a lot of ways, a giveaway to the private insurance companies. Yes. Did the stimulus not go far enough? You know, I tend to agree with that. And that has to do with, sort of the realities of the Senate and the realities of Congress that they've come up against. And I think that the question again is, and I'm not, I read Paul Krugman's columns in the New York Times, I think, like everybody else. And I defer to him a lot on the sort of core questions of economics. I'm obviously not an economist. And so I read his columns and I get the impression that, wow, this is, it's doom and gloom here. This is, this is sort of a fatal mistake of the Obama presidency, and this economy is just not going to turn around enough. But I also, I also look at, as I said, historically, if you look at other turnarounds, other economic turnarounds, they weren't always it didn't, you know, sort of the darkest hour before dawn, you know, thinking kind of applied. If you looked at 1982 with Ronald Reagan, you know, people were saying, even within the Republican Party, wow, it's just not going to turn around here. It's just not, he's not done enough. And then it did, and a lot of the criticism kind of went away. And I could still see that happening with the economy. You know, now if the economy does improve in the next 2 years, you know, I think a lot of these concerns, it's just the reality of politics. They might be perfectly valid from a policy standpoint, but a lot of them just kind of go away.
Mm-hmm. Matt is next in Madison. Hi, Matt.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Thank you. I want to build a little bit on the previous caller's questions, which I don't think got enough attention, and that has to do with, or at least what he was implicitly referring to, and that has to do with the fact that it was never, and I think this needs to be emphasized and underscored, and I find it almost appalling that it never gets enough attention in the media, that it was never the tax cuts that Reagan pushed through, okay, that got the economy jump-started, but it was government spending spurred on by something called the arms race, okay, which put people back to work. I mean, that was a form of government spending that we had not seen since the Second World War and also since the Great Society, for that matter. So I'd like to get the speaker's comments on that, and also to comment a little bit about how that is, in fact, building on what the other caller said, about how that is, in fact, another form of deficit spending.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, if the subject is deficit spending, the expert is Ronald Reagan and the people in his administration, because you can look at, you know, the massive deficits that we racked up in the 1980s. You know, taking the national debt went from under a trillion, I think, when he came into office in 1981, it was nearly 3 trillion when he left office in 1989. That's obviously massive growth by any standard. The point that I would make about Reagan is the idea that the defense spending played such a big role in the economic turnaround, I think is probably valid. The point that I'm making about public opinion, about the perception of presidents, though, I think still stands. The story of Reagan's sort of political turnaround between 1982 and 1984, I think, tells you an awful lot about public opinion. I think it's all still valid today. In the public's mind, the story was always, you know, the economy was absolutely stalled when Ronald Reagan came into office. He campaigned against the misery index. That was the combination of inflation and unemployment, and it was over 20% under Jimmy Carter. He campaigned against that, and his signature achievement in the public's eye was getting this massive tax cut program through in his first, you know, 6 months of office. And that became sort of the standard of his presidency. That was, you know, will the economy turn around or not? And if it does, you know, the public was going to credit it to that program. If it doesn't, you know, they weren't. And then he paid a big price in 1982 because the economy hadn't started to turn around. And then, you know, by election day 1984, the unemployment rate, what's interesting actually is the unemployment rate on election day 1984 was higher than it was when he came into office. It was higher on election day 1984 than it was on inauguration day 1981, but it was down about 2.5 points from its peak in January 1983. So that looked like big progress to everybody, and it created this national mood of optimism. And that national mood then sort of expressed itself in the polls about Ronald Reagan. Is he doing a good job? Yes. Has his economic program worked? Well, sure it has. Do you approve of this? Sure. The interesting thing was, on specific issues, his ideology was very much out of step with most Americans. If you asked him about you know, his stance on you know, social welfare programs, for instance, he was always, you know, for his entire presidency, he was always very much out of step with Americans. In 1982, when his party suffered massive losses in the midterm elections, that was seen as a big problem. In 1984 and later on, it wasn't. Because, you know, as his example showed, I think, you know, people really just sort of care about the state of the economy. And if it's going well, they will give the president credit for it. And that's sort of they're not going to get any more sort of in-depth than that. And I think that's, you know, it's unfortunate in some ways, but I mean, that's the reality that Barack Obama is dealing with too, I think. If the economy turns around, he will get the credit for it, and his stimulus will get the credit for it.
And thank you, Matt, very much for your call. We go next to Paul in La Crosse. Hello, Paul.
Good morning. Yes, Dina Milbanks wrote a story this week about, or last week, about that billboard that was put up and then immediately taken down showing Obama, Stalin, and Hitler, different kinds of socialism. And it really offended a lot of people. I think that the idea with Dina Milbanks' story was that Iowa's always had this national prestige of being the first one to go because it's good middle American state and all the rest of that. But he's feeling now that maybe that image has been tarnished by the billboard, and that therefore the Iowa brand won't be as big as it's been in the past, you know, in 2 years from now. I was wondering, you know, from what you've seen in Washington, are the pundits starting to take a different look at, you know, Iowa? Is Terry Branston, you know, being endorsed by Sarah Palin going to hurt him? What do you think will happen in Iowa in 2 years?
Well, I don't think anybody's, you know, looking at it from that standpoint of, you know, wow, we've this sort of shows us that that we were wrong to put so much importance on Iowa. I mean, I think it's long been known that there's a very very vocal, prominent, you know, a chunk of the sort of Republican Party in Iowa that's extremely conservative. I mean, it was 22 years ago in 1988 that Pat Robertson, you know, a televangelist, ran for president and came in second place in the Iowa caucuses, defeated a sitting vice president, George H.W. Bush, and nearly destroyed George H.W. Bush's campaign for president in 1988 by scoring 25% in the Iowa caucuses that year. So from that moment on, if not earlier, it was very clear that, you know, that this sort of very, very sort of right-wing core exists in the Republican Party in Iowa, which isn't to say that all Pat Robertson supporters would be putting up this kind of billboard or anything, but I don't think it's disturbing in some ways. I don't think it's a huge revelation about Iowa. I mean, don't forget, Iowa on the other side is also the state that in 2008 launched, you know, Obama's campaign. It launched. This is a state that's white, very, very small African American population, and yet it gave, you know, Barack Obama nearly 40% in the 2008 caucuses, and created this momentum that Hillary Clinton temporarily, you know, upended with a win in New Hampshire the next week, but then was ultimately just not able to overcome. So Iowa also, you know, if we're going to say, well, there's some sort of crazies on the right there, you know, I think you also have to acknowledge that it's sort of amazing that an electorate in an all-white state like that would play such an important role in launching the campaign of the first black president.
Let's circle back to those poll numbers and our perceptions of him for a while. This brought to mind by the billboard, and also about what you wrote about in your piece about these numbers. When you break them down, one of the groups that you cite is the diehard GOP base, the 25 to 30% of voters who still gave George Bush positive ratings in the final days of his presidency. They would oppose Obama on health care, fiscal responsibility, or even socialism/communism as a reason for rating him negatively. Then you've got progressives on the Democratic Party who would say he's way too moderate. Skip this socialism-communism business. He's cozied up to Wall Street. He's got the same advisors. Isn't it kind of odd that his approval numbers have gone down because some people think he's a socialist and some people think he's too much of a capitalist?
It's the ultimate, you know, I get, depending on who I talk to, I get really strange looks, or sometimes I get nods of approval when I say this, but if you look at the health care bill, I maintain that the left has a lot more reason to be up in arms over the health care bill than the right does. I mean, you'd never know that because, I mean, if you remember the weekend that thing was passed, all of the, you know, thousands of right-wing activists descended on Washington and were just talking about how the country was about to be, you know, utterly ruined by this thing, while the left was, you know, sort of, you know, for the most part, kind of, you know, grudgingly going along with it. But I think if you actually look at what's in the health care plan, you know, as you say, it is a giveaway to the insurance industry. The private insurance industry is stronger than ever as a result of the health care bill. They get tens of millions of new customers, many of them
some healthy, you know, 20 and 30 somethings who aren't going to cost the insurance companies anything, and they're just going to pay their premiums every month. And that's basically it. He strengthened the private sector in a way that that the private sector has been hoping for, you know, for years, really. And all they have to do is just, you know, sort of stop denying people coverage on the basis of pre-existing conditions. They're willing to pay that price if it means getting, you know, all these new customers. So from a strictly policy standpoint, I've always said, you know, the left, which at sort of the core of the left, wants a universal, you know, single-payer healthcare system, and if not that, at least, you know, a really strong, meaningful public option, got none of that. And the right got, you know, a strengthened private sector. But if you listen to the rhetoric, it's, you know, it's just all about socialism, communism coming from the right. And I think that tells you two things. One is just, as I said, the sort of rejectionist strategy that the Republicans pursued, you know, from the very beginning. You know, so they were going to oppose anything and they were going to talk about how terrible it was. But I think the second thing is the tougher one to sort of express and to define, but it's sort of I really believe it's just sort of a cultural reaction. And I'm not, I want to be, you know, sort of careful how I phrase that, because I'm not, you know, I don't, you know, like to say, oh, it's, you know, the right wing or the Tea Party is, you know, is filled with racists who just can't stand a black president. But I think there's a variety of things about Obama, about the Obama movement, about the Democratic Party, about progressives. There's a variety of things that just sort of set off sort of this really strong, powerful, it really at its core emotional reaction on the right. Yes. In this country. And Obama and his supporters, I think, embody more of those things that sort of set off those alarm bells than most politicians on the left. But it's also not a particularly new phenomenon. I mean, if you think back to the first 2 years of the Clinton presidency, I think the right wing was just as rabidly anti-Clinton as it is now anti-Obama, and just as hysterically rabid. I mean, I remember, you know, there were videos being circulated when Bill Clinton was president that accused him of drug running as Arkansas governor, that accused him and accused his wife of murder, you know, with Vince Foster, you know, all of these things. I mean, it very much calls to mind what we're hearing now from the right about Barack Obama. I mean, the difference back then was we didn't have this catch-all name, you know, the Tea Party movement to sort of encapsulate it. But I think there was a Tea Party movement in 1993 and 1994 in everything but name.
We are talking about all things political this hour of the program. Steve Kornacki is our guest, news editor for Salon. One line is open at 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We talk about To Kill a Mockingbird, celebrating its 50th anniversary, the book that is, this year. And our guests include Mary Badham, who played Scout 50 years ago in To Kill a Mockingbird. Back to phone calls. We go to Jim in Milwaukee. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to talk today a little bit about the lack of trust and also some possible changes through the book on Alan Greenspan called Greenspan's Fraud by Ravi Batra, which I think is a good book. It's a complicated book, not an easy read for those of us not sophisticated in economics. But the first problem of trust I have is that it seems to me that the public in general seems to be very apathetic and unwilling to make the effort to read serious books like this, which, of course, involves a lack of effort and lack of interest in responsible performance. But it goes beyond that. In solving the problems of the society and especially the economy, it comes into who we're going to trust on this. Are we going to trust the people who were destroying the middle class in the past by their policies? Are we going to trust people who are obstructing change in the present? And are we going to trust people who promise for the future that if we just restore them to power, that we're going to be able to bring back the economic security and the American dream for the American people? What I'd like to know is where the proof of this is. You know, in theory, anybody can run anything. In theory, the Republicans can run the government. In theory, the corporate wing of the Democratic Party can run the government. In theory, a group of pedophiles could run a daycare center. But right now, I don't have much trust in any of those three groups being able to do anything positive that wouldn't be involved in hurting people. The one group of people that I do trust are progressives, because they're caring about the needs of the people. They're interested in creating rules that will help regulate the government so that in the interest of the people, they're interested in enforcing the law and they're interested in bringing positive or consequences for violations of the law. And we have to have something that we can have some trust in.
Steve.
Yeah, I mean, it's the message there. What strikes me from that comment is, you know, I think I hate to sort of sound like a broken record with this, but I think it's the kind of message that it will resonate more with voters if the economy improves, because I believe that changes the mood so much. If you look at if you take right now, Democratic Party, progressives in general, Barack Obama, are all viewed very skeptically in public opinion polls, because right now people, I think if you look at mass opinion, it sort of looks at the ruling Democrats and it says, well, you know, the economy is not improving. We're sort of bogged down in Afghanistan. I don't feel good about, you know, the country's, the direction of the country's going in. I don't necessarily feel good about my life or the life of people around me. And that expresses itself in sort of just all these different ways in terms of disapproval. But I think if the economy turns around, then people start looking, first of all, as I said, more favorably, you know, at Obama and at the Democrats. But they also, I think, then start developing more of a sense of perspective. And I think then when you start, you know, drawing, you know, comparisons to, well, hey, look what Obama's done and look what it was like under Bush, or look what progressives stand for and look what the Bush-Cheney record was, look what the Republican Congress in the late 90s did. You know, those sorts of comparisons, I think, start to have a lot more impact if people feel that the Democrats who have been given the White House, have been given large majorities in both the House and the Senate, if they feel that Democrats have delivered on something and improved their lives in a meaningful way, then I think it's not just about the economy. I think it's just in general people start are very receptive to the idea of, you know, yeah, not only were we right to be upset with the Republicans after all the years that they had in power, but our decision to hand it over, you know, to hand power over to the Democrats was the right one. We don't want to ever, you know, or we don't want for the foreseeable future, you know, to go back to what things were. I think that message really, though, only works when the Democrats can say they've sort of delivered on something.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to jobs for just a moment, because it seems to me as though that's really key to those approval numbers, and you write about that in your article as well, that the economy simply needs to get better. We had talked about the arms race and a little bit about World War II and the jobs that were created in the defense industry as a result of that war. Do you think that the president is meeting with advisors to come up with some kind of massive job plan? Do you think that he's entertained the possibility of Krugman's suggestion that public works programs to put people to work would help the country and help the economy significantly? This idea that he's not really tackling what seems to be a huge problem is troubling.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's something that is discussed quite a bit and that comes up a lot, and I'm sure there's a lot of he's hearing a lot of voices in his ear saying exactly that. My sense is the holdup is the reality of how can you get that through Congress? How can you get United States Senate that balked at a stimulus package that would one penny larger than what went through last year in the United States Senate? We were not going to have enough votes in the United States Senate to pass it. So how can you go and pass a substantial public works program now, even if you can establish that sort of from a policy standpoint, it's absolutely the right thing to do. One thought that's sort of out there is, you know, potentially you'll have this lame duck congressional session after the election this year. And this could take on more significance, I guess, if there's a Republican takeover. But there could be a window in there later this year. You know, lame duck session is typically when things are passed that are viewed as a little more politically poisonous. The election is as far away as it could possibly be. The election just happened. The next one's, you know, not basically for 2 years, and you have sort of a window. Maybe to be a little more bold, a little more risky in what you enact. So there's potentially a window there. There's some flexibility in terms of sort of small scale stuff. You know, Scott Brown, the new Republican senator from Massachusetts, was willing to work on a jobs bill that Harry Reid put together. He was, you know, Scott Brown was willing to break with the Republicans to support that, to provide critical support for that, you know, earlier this year. Not a large scale thing, not necessarily something that's going to turn the economy around,
by itself. But you could find, you know, you could find some support from a guy like Scott Brown, from Olympia Snow, from Susan Collins for smaller scale stuff. But when you start talking about, I think that the kind of scope that a guy like Paul Krugman is talking about, my read on it is sort of like, I read the arguments for it and they resonate with me. I just can't see how you get that through Congress.
Right. All right. Let's go. Thanks, Jim. Wayne from Holman. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hello, Wayne.
Good morning to your guest. I guess I'm kind of a conservative fella, and you might want to call me a Tea Party person or someone that has attended town hall meetings. And I find that of the total population, the folks that I see at Tea Parties, maybe 1%, I think, go over the top. And I think leadership in the Tea Party movement needs to condemn that. And I fully agree. Only with the
NAACP, we got you.
You got me. But anyway, I'm wondering what the guest would think, and I think he's trying to be fair. I recall during George Bush 43's term, he was called about every filthy name you can think of. There were pictures of him with a mustache under his nose and, looking like Hitler, and I didn't hear the outcry from the left that I hear from those folks now on the left regarding Barack Obama, and I fully agree people should be criticized. But for example, for Nancy Pelosi to refer to me as a brown shirt in AstroTurf, I find that very offensive, and I don't hear the outrage from you folks on the left in regards to that particular those commentaries. And could I have your response, sir? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Wayne.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I feel like, yes, okay, under Bush, it was anybody who called Bush Hitler was going too far, and just in general, Hitler comparisons should be totally off limits. I think there are a lot of ways to answer this. I think the simplest way to answer this, though, is to say people on the left, I think, responded to what they perceived as very selective outrage from the Tea Party crowd, that basically immediately when Barack Obama became president, immediately after Barack Obama was elected president, you began having this Tea Party movement that was rising up against massive spending, that was rising up against spending, that was rising up against, taxes, all these things. And the question that Democrats asked, the question that people on the left asked is, where was this for the last 8 years? Where was this in 2004 when the right rallied around George W. Bush? Where was this, where was this during the Bush presidency? It seemed like, there's sort of a putting the cart before the horse. Well, okay, the Democrats are president. Now we're going to speak up. Now we're going to reject. Now we're going to obstruct. Okay, by the way, what are the arguments we should make? And I think one of the iconic moment, I think, from the town hall protest last summer that I think stands with Democrats is, there was more than one instance of this, too. Somebody getting up at one of these town hall meetings and essentially saying, I don't want the government running my health care. Keep your hands off my Medicare. And just this sort of it's sort of irrational nature of the message of, not even understanding that we already have government-run health care. And then, standing up and sort of being part of this crusade against, basically something we already have.
Mike in Appleton, hi.
Yeah, thank you. I have two comments about a couple of your comments and then a question. You say that you defer to Krugman. I find that frightening. And then you talk about Obama's extraordinary legislation, but then you contradicted yourself and said it was full of loopholes. So I don't see anything extraordinary about that.
I can't hear you very well. It was full of what? Mike, I can't hear you.
Hello?
Yeah.
I think he was saying loopholes.
Loopholes, all right.
Loopholes.
All right.
Okay. My question. I see that the Republican Party is in disarray, and my question to you is, at what point in time, given the immensely long lead that is needed on something like this, do they have to come up with their candidate who's going to run against Obama?
Right. Well, that's the point I'm sort of making about 2012. I mean, the sort of Cliff's Notes version of what I think about 2012 is, as I said, if the economy turns around, it doesn't matter who the Republicans nominate. Barack Obama's reelected. Now, it's a competitive race if the economy has not turned around. Then it's very important. The question of who the Republicans nominate is very important. It's very relevant. And there's potentially an opportunity for the Democrats, if the Republicans nominate the wrong candidate, there's potentially an opportunity for the Democrats to turn the race around, to sort of turn the tables and make it as much a referendum on the Republican as it is on Obama. And if the Republicans, as you say, the party's in disarray, in a lot of ways, I agree with that. And there are a lot of, you know, sort of from a pragmatic political standpoint, there are a lot of sort of frightening options the Republicans could come up with that would really kind of shoot themselves in the foot for 2012. At the head of that list is Sarah Palin. My sense now is that she's going to run. I don't think she'll win the nomination, but it's possible. It's absolutely possible she'll win the nomination. And if she does, I think even then, if the economy, you know, favors the Republicans on paper, I think it's Barack Obama's election to lose at that point. Conversely, if the Republicans put up somebody like Mitt Romney, Mitt Romney has lots of flaws, and I have been more than happy to document them, you know, for the last really, you know, 5 years. I grew up watching this guy in Massachusetts. But I really believe that a guy like Mitt Romney in 2012, just strictly from sort of a political standpoint, if the economy is down, would really kind of maximize the Republican Party's chances of winning that election. Now, would the Republicans make a pragmatic choice in 2012, or will this sort of Tea Party mentality still have a grip on the party? If that Tea Party mentality, that sort of revolutionary mentality, still has a grip on the party, then you're going to get a candidate like Sarah Palin, and you're going to squander a winnable election if the economy's down. So that's absolutely a possibility at this point, and I can't, you know, obviously right now predict, you know, what it'll be. But if it is Sarah Palin, it's big trouble for the Republicans. Mm.
Steve, thank you so much for being with us. You're a wonderful guest.
Sure. Happy to do it.
Thanks. Steve Kornacki, news editor for Salon, our guest this hour for All Things Political. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee in the Royce Federal Building. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We have news coming up and another wonderful hour, so please stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.